Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Malampy. She's a lawyer whose work focuses on animal rights and protection. And we're talking about her new book, Forget the Camel, The Madcap World of Animal Festivals and What They Say About Being Human. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a unique book, and it's a travel book. You traveled literally around the United States. But the story of this book, the generation of this book, starts with your grandmother. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so my grandmother was a veterinarian and an anthropologist who studied human-animal relationships. And before she died, she was starting to think about a book about animal festivals around the world, sort of like a more like an academic textbook, kind of an anthology about these events that happen and a little bit about what makes each one sort of special. And unfortunately, she passed away before she was able to finish her work on that book. And all that remained of it was a handful of sort of boxes of files and clippings and notes and that sort of thing that my parents had kept in their house. So during COVID, I rediscovered some of these notes. I sort of heard of one of these events, and it piqued about my grandmother going to these events and studying these festivals, and I sort of was curious what was left of them, if any of them were still happening, why and what's going on. And I was just sort of, curious to retrace my grandmother's steps and try to see what she saw. So that was the original impetus for starting this research.
Now, you're an animal rights person and a vegetarian, which really informs your reporting on these events. But the way I ended up looking at it is finally somebody's sort of taking the animal's point of view and reporting on these. And the stories ranged incredibly. I mean, from a one end is the grotesque and bizarre rattlesnake roundup. And then on the other end is this butterfly celebration. Mm-hmm. And then there's all this other crap in between, which some of it just is insane, like the camel races. But, I mean, were you prepared for this journey? It sounds like you're there with your wife. God knows what she's like, but she put up with an awful lot. Weird crap to bring your significant other to.
Yes, she's a saint for...
Are you still together?
but it was nice, it doubled the things that we could see. There were two sets of eyes trying to, catch interesting things, and two sets of ears. And it also provided a really good opportunity for me to have just like a conversation partner about what we were seeing and ideas that were coming up and that sort of thing. I always made it clear to my wife that she didn't have to come, but she said, she felt like she was in it for the long haul once she started going to a few of these.
And like I said, you are still together.
Yes.
Okay. I think she should write a book on going through this thing with you. But are they in the book? Are they in the order that you went to them?
No. So I went to them in the order that they just sort of took place over the year and a half that I was doing the research. The order in the book follows sort of like what I think could be a sort of an arc or a journey of how humans can relate to animals kind of more broadly. So I use these festivals as kind of like jumping off points for how we think about and talk about and sort of make assumptions about animals sort of in our daily life. So even though, most people haven't been to these particular events, I think most people interact with animals in ways that these events capture. So the book is organized into three parts. And the first is dominance, which is sort of the most obvious and exploitative uses of animals. The second is humor, which is sort of the type of way we relate to animals that's almost like unthinking. It's just sort of ambivalent and, just sort of treats animals like kind of like props on the side. And then the third section is reverence, which looks at events that hold animals up on a pedestal and try to, say something about how special they are or something like that. So those three categories are how I bucket the events. And then, I think of the book very much as a spectrum from one extreme end all the way sort of to the other.
Although I was surprised that Groundhog Day was in that last section and not the
reverence.
Yeah, as opposed to the middle section.
I mean, it certainly could be in either. And again, that's sort of like I view these less as concrete buckets and more as a spectrum. So like the journey from each festival to the next, even within the within a section. I think, you know, you add something about how we relate to animals at that festival is slightly different than the one before it.
Now, I want to start with talking about the Iditarod. I actually did an interview several years ago with a woman who was one of the people that raced wow. in the Iditarod. And when I read her book, I came away feeling to a degree exactly like how you were reporting, like the dogs. First of all, let's describe the race and what it's like for the dogs.
Sure. So the Iditarod race is about 1,000 miles through rural Alaska. It starts just north of Anchorage and works its way up along the historic Iditarod Trail to a rural town called Nome, Alaska. So it's 1,000 miles, give or take, and the dogs run it continuously. So the same dogs that start the race finish the race. It's not a relay or anything like that. And so because of that, as you can imagine, pushing dogs to run over 1,000 miles in 8 or 9 days is kind of like an unbelievably difficult and challenging physical event for the dogs. And, every year dogs really suffer. Sometimes it's, hurt paws, broken tendons or hurt tendons and ligaments in their legs. Sometimes it's systemic things like diarrhea or illness. Other times dogs have died on the trail. Over the course of the history of the dogs, of the race, over 100 dogs have died. A dog just died this past year that was found to be pregnant once they investigated the body after the death. So every year this is sort of the risk that happens, is that dogs are being pushed sort of past their body's limits. And on the other hand, the race is a very important kind of part of Alaskan culture. It really brings up sort of that identity of, dog sledding is really important to Alaska.
Well, that's true in every one of these cases that you talk about. There's always a unique historical story for that town or place where these events take place. Mm-hmm. And it ends up, this becomes like an event by which the town identifies and also usually raises some money. Mm-hmm. The history of the Iditarod goes way back to a specific event, though, in this case.
So in 1925, about 100 years ago this year, there was a outbreak of diphtheria in the town where the Iditarod ends, in Nome, Alaska. And in order to save the town from this epidemic that was striking them, they had to figure out a way to get more antitoxin or more sort of treatment to this town. That treatment existed. It was out there. They just didn't have enough. And kids were starting to die. People were starting to die. And this was a preventable disease, or a curable disease, I should say. And it was only their sort of remoteness that made it such a challenge. And so this was before air travel was safe in the winter, and it was, this town is landlocked. There's no roads that go to it. The only way in is by dog sled or by boat, but because it was winter, the harbor had frozen over, so dog sledding became the avenue that they decided to get the serum up to the town to save the people from this disease. And in order to do this, they had a relay, so they went along loosely along the same trail, in a relay to get the antitoxin to the town, which, saved tons of lives and sort of became this this remarkable story about the resilience of the dogs, the sort of heroism of this event. This was covered nationally all across the country. People were following this live at the time in 1925, but it also is a story that has a lot of outsized importance kind of even today. I grew up watching the animated movie Balto,
yep.
about this. So it's definitely a legend that has lasted in our American sort of ideas.
But how much time was there? How many years between the specific historical event and then it becoming like a yearly thing?
The historical event was in 1925. And then I think it wasn't until later in the 20th century that they started doing the Iditarod race, and they actually, the events actually aren't literally connected. The start of the Iditarod race was meant to sort of celebrate Alaskan culture and history, and that they just sort of created it, and they've been doing it every year ever since. And a lot of the events in this book have origin stories like that, where it's just sort of sometimes someone starts it, and then it's every year we do it again, and so it becomes self-justifying, you know, because people say, oh, we do this every year, but that's actually not like a reason. That is just a habit, and so I think it starts to raise some questions about, you know, why exactly do we do this every year?
Well, also the excuse is it raises a lot of money.
Yeah,
for that town or whatever, and therefore you don't dare not do it. There's that sort of hanging on. But getting back to the dogs, the conversations that you hear about, Jesus, is it really fair to do this to a dog? People will tell you, well, the dogs were born to do this. Mm-hmm. They look forward that they're only happy when they're out overextending themselves in the snow and the cold. How often did you hear that as the excuse?
Oh, all the time. I mean, that is the justification for sure. And I think, you know, to some extent, I think it's true. I think these dogs are bred to run. I think they're bred to want to run and to want to pull. And I think that might be totally accurate. I think what I and what other sort of animal-minded people push back on is the idea that being born to run doesn't make running 1,000 miles over, you know, just over a week, sort of an ethical, humane thing to do. The one doesn't follow from the other. And I think, running a handful of miles or even a couple hundred miles is really different than running over 1,000. So I think there is just a question of scale, even if the dogs are bred to, you know, for this particular purpose of running and pulling. And I think that, it doesn't sort of answer the right question. It just sort of creates more justification for how we can rationalize doing this to dogs.
Is it at all politicized?
The Iditarod, you know, I think it, a lot of these events are more sort of cross-cutting. Like it's not like, you know, all of one political party love it and the other hates it or vice versa. I think these events kind of transcend some of that. And because they're about animals, I think we often can put some of that stuff aside and have, you know, more of a cultural meeting grounds across that. So I don't think there was strong sort of political opposition one way or the other.
Now, I got to mention the rattlesnake roundup in Sweetwater, Texas. I really appreciate your reporting on this. I knew about it. I just didn't want to know about the details. And this is pretty grisly. And there's just no two ways about it. Why is this happening?
The rattlesnake roundup has been happening for decades, and it's not unique to Sweetwater, Texas. These snake roundups happen, sort of all across the South, and they've taken different forms over the years, but in Sweetwater, Texas, the one that I attended, they self-proclaim to be the world's largest rattlesnake roundup. And what they do is they have hunters who spend, you know, the weeks and months before the roundup hunting snakes from the wild, from out in the, in, you know, out in Texas. And they, in order to do that, they pump gasoline into the back of the snake dens, which, you know, kind of confuses them, makes them feel awful, and then they stumble out of the snake dens and are captured sort of in that state. And so because they're alive, when they're brought into the rattlesnake roundup in the center of town, they, you know, the point of the roundup is to kill them. And so how they do that at...
why do they feel they have to kill them?
Because rattlesnakes are dangerous. And
I don't want to say they're dangerous. Their
that's
point,
what they would say.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
What they would say.
They're poisonous, the one thing about rattlesnakes is the reason they have a rattle is to warn you off. Mm-hmm. And most rattlesnake bites that happen have because people are mishandling them or
exactly.
Doing something like they shouldn't with a rattlesnake. So, there are some accidents, but they're saying that the rattlesnakes are such a danger that we have to kill them. But there's so many snakes, rattlesnakes, killed in that you reported on. They can't be just from the immediate area.
I think that's what a lot of activists say. And there's lots of sort of questions about where these snakes come from and you know, the practices that they use to get the snakes out of the dens. I mean, the gassing of the dens hurts other animals that share mm-hmm. the dens with the snakes. It also, you know, it obviously negatively impacts the environment when you're just dumping gasoline on it. And so there's definitely a lot of questions that activists and animal advocates have raised about this event and about the practices that lead up to it. You know, in some of the snakes that they do capture, some of them are reportedly kept for weeks before the roundup. And so, you know, they're not being fed, they're not getting water, they're just sort of like lying there in a pit. And it's it definitely, you know, raises my hackles and makes me feel pretty awful. I think that is a hard way to treat any animal, even if we don't like snakes.
Well, I'll have to make a confession that I do. And I always have found this just heinous. That then I read your reporting on it, and it was worse than I ever thought. Because not only they're not just killing them, it's a spectacle.
It is. So they're not killing snakes in sort of a humane or even kind of quiet way. You know, I think one way to effectuate this purported goal of safety and sort of reducing the rattlesnake populations would be just to kill the snakes when they find them, kind of humanely.
Right.
And instead, they bring them in and they do this in public in this very spectacle, like you said, way. And what they do is they behead the snakes one by one, sort of in full view of the public, just like with a machete on a stump. And it's a very bloody thing. And then once the snakes are beheaded, they skin the snakes and, you know, sort of sell the snake skin. They fry and sell the meat. Sort of every piece of the snake gets deconstructed and used and sold to visitors.
And they're making comments while they're doing it.
Yeah, there's a lot of sort of moralizing rhetoric that I heard and a lot of just a way of understanding snakes that I think is really different, you know, than how I do. I think they think these snakes are dangerous. They think they're evil. And I think those comments teach attendees to also think that snakes are dangerous.
Well, as you're right, female rattlesnakes were described as sluts.
Yeah, yeah. Because they leave their babies and keep on going, I think was the quote that I heard.
As do most reptiles.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I guess fair warning to listeners, that part of the book was pretty extreme. How did you get through it?
It was hard. You know, I think that it was one of the strangest things and hardest things that I've seen. And I think that some of it, I got through it, I guess, because I was convinced and sort of had a conviction that it belonged in this book. And that I think
it does. Yeah.
The more people that know about it, I think the more pressure there will be on these organizers to change how they operate. So in Georgia, as a counterexample, they used to have rattlesnake roundups just like this one in Sweetwater. They would kill the snakes in public and everything, but they've transitioned to no-kill roundups. So they have some snakes that they bring in who are sort of been rescued and rehabilitated, and they educate the public about snakes and about snake safety and about handling
cool.
safety and all of that. And they still have the fair and, you know, the fried food for sale outside and all of those things. But they don't actually kill snakes. So the center of the festival has changed. And those events, you know, I think seem to be going off just fine. And so Sweetwater, you know, they're sticking to the killing. But I guess my point is that it's not inevitable. And there's an example for that they could follow for how to transition this out of that phase of, you know, sort of violence.
The other weird thing about all these events is that there was always a Miss Blank. So there was a Miss Rattlesnake, right?
Yeah, Miss Snake, yes. And a lot of these events have pageants associated with them. It's just like, you know, I think kind of classic Americana, how we kind of celebrate small town life. You know, I think that's really common.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Elizabeth Malampi. She's a lawyer whose work focuses on animal rights and protection. And we're talking about her new book, which is a fascinating read, Forget the Camel, The Madcap World of Animal Festivals and What They Say About Being Human. And I feel like we need to end on a more upbeat sort of wild note. Groundhog Day. I knew something about Groundhog Day. I didn't know all the insanity about Groundhog Day. There's just so much weird stuff that goes on.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically a giant pre-dawn party. So around 3 a.m., this all gets going. And there's live music. There's, you know, lots of there's people are sort of celebrating, cheering. There's, you know, coffee and donuts for sale. There's, like, fireworks a little later in the morning. It's kind of like a nonstop party for the
but
4 hours.
You had to get tickets in advance for certain events.
Yeah, yeah, you had to get tickets in advance, and they sold out. I was really lucky to get the ones that I got.
And there's this whole inner circle.
Yeah, the inner circle are the ones who sort of run Groundhog Day. So it's a group of men who, you know, they think they do a lot of the logistics, and they care for Phil year-round, Phil and his wife Phyllis, the two groundhogs. And on Groundhog Day itself, the president of the inner circle is the one who actually talks to Phil to receive his prognostication about the weather.
And there's there's poems, there's proclamations, there's stories that It's the same Phil. Phil is immortal.
Yeah, it's sort of this funny thing. I think it's just like evolved over the years to be almost purposely absurd. And I think they like making a joke of it all. And I think the poems and the songs and people were wearing like leggings with Phil's face all printed all over them. I saw multiple people dressed up as groundhogs. Like it just sort of kind of takes on this absurdity, which I think made it really fun. You know, that was actually one of the funnest, you know, the most fun events that we went to. I think it was really fun. It's just this crazy thing.
But beyond all of this, there's a whole other level of your book, and I want to make sure we pay attention to, and that's how basically getting to the root of how humans think about non-human life.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the conclusions you came from seeing all these weird festivals, frog jumping, butterflies, camel racing?
So I think one of the things that convinced me to continue working on this book was that the more I worked on it, the more animal festivals I found, the more I came across. You know, every time I talked to someone, I explained that I was working on this book. I sort of explained what it was about. Almost without fail, I've heard, oh, have you heard of, you know, this festival that it takes place in my hometown, or this festival that took place, you know, when I was in college, I saw it in that town or wherever. And I've heard so many stories of different animal festivals around the country, and a lot of them are really small, kind of like not necessarily nationally noteworthy or anything like that, you know, not like the Iditarod or some of these ones that we've heard of, but just sort of events that happen all over the place all the time, year round. And I was sort of kind of blown away by the scale of this phenomenon when you zoom out. So any one of these events, you know, I think is by the numbers pretty small, both by the numbers of animals it affects and by the numbers of humans that attend and sort of care about this. But when you zoom out, you can sort of see that it's a broader phenomenon. You know, all across the country, and I think across the world, we use animals to try to like figure out who we are as humans. You know, we use them as foils and as scapegoats and as props and as storytelling tools, and we use them for all of these purposes that I think are essentially part of how we are navigating who we are as humans on this planet. Because I think that's like, it's a really hard question, and since the beginning of time we've shared this planet with animals, and so I think it's sort of an essential, like, existential question that we kind of both consciously and subconsciously are often trying to answer when we're navigating our relationships with animals, is like, what makes us different from them? And I think these festivals are part of that. It's part of that questioning and answering, and part of sort of building the relationship that we have with animals, sort of reestablishing the boundaries between us and them, is these events where you're playing with animals, you're using animals to tell these stories. But at the end of the day, the festivals wrap up and, you know, the animals are killed or released to the wild or sent back to their domesticated, you know, cage or whatever, and you go on about your merry life. And I think that it is part of this kind of boundary making between us and them.
It's funny because when I got to the end of the book, I started to see a connection between these celebrations, or whatever you want to call them, events, and medieval things like bear baiting, and other animal-centered and rather cruel always events. And again, a lot of it has to do with the sort of a Western tradition of humans being the crown of creation and looking as the ultimate on Earth, and therefore everything else is there for us to use.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think that mindset leads to a lot of these events, and I think it certainly is part of the more violent events, is this idea that, you know, we're in charge and we get to decide how this happens, and we just wanting to do this is enough. That's enough of a justification. And I think that's a really, in my mind, sort of dangerous philosophy, and I think it's one that I've continued to try to push back on in my career and in sort of my thinking about animals. Is, you know, we're humans, being human does mean something special. I believe that. I think you look around and being human is sort of a remarkable thing, but it's also not a license to be cruel to the rest of the animal kingdom. And so I think that this book tries to use these festivals, like you said, as kind of opening, like an opening entryway to that conversation of how do we treat animals when we're not really thinking about it. I think, you know, we all know not to kick our dog, right? But when you're sort of pressed with this festival that doesn't seem so bad, but isn't letting the animal be its own self in its own habitat, you know, what do you do? Do you just attend and kind of smile? Do you protest? Like, I think it raises these questions in sort of a an environment that we're not really used to talking about animals in that way. So it definitely is from that perspective of humans being on top of the food chain that I wanted to start. And then I think the book starts there. And then I think it carries the reader through to a more hopeful place. You know, I don't think there's ever.
I thought the Butterfly Festival was a total sort of positive.
Yeah. So the very last festival in the book before the conclusion is a butterfly parade that I went to in Pacific Grove, California, where they basically welcome the return of the migrating monarch butterflies with this very quaint parade where kindergartners dress up like monarchs. I mean, it's very small town, very quaint. And, you know, I think it's not realistic to say, let's stop using animals for our celebrations, or let's stop, you know, using animals as symbols to help us understand the world. That's just not going to happen. Like, we're our species as humans, we are very symbolic. Like, we think in symbols and we look around the world and we use them all the time. And so I think the Butterfly Festival offers an example of how a festival can be sort of good for animals. It can raise awareness about them, and it can meet them where they're at instead of bringing them into our human worlds. And it can be not based in dominance, but based in something much more respectful.
And you went out and actually tried to see a monarch.
Yeah. So in Pacific Grove, there's a monarch sanctuary where the monarch butterflies, when they migrate back for the winter, they sort of congregate on this particular group of trees that has now been protected as a sanctuary. And so when I went for the festival, for the parade, we stopped in the sanctuary to sort of see it and to try to spot any monarchs, but it was still a little early.
But you did see one.
We did see one. Yeah.
Okay, well, don't give it away yet because we're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Elizabeth Malapi. She's a lawyer whose work focuses on animal rights and protection. And we're talking about her new book. It's a roller coaster ride. Forget the Camel, the Madcap World of Animal Festivals and What They Say About Being Human. Elizabeth, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.